live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. Today, we're going to take a little deeper look at aluminum, because some new research is now showing that it does indeed contribute to Alzheimer's disease. So we'll examine the ways we use aluminum, are not aware that it's harmful, but it actually is. Also, we're going to take a look at how the federal government works with pharmaceutical companies to prevent natural cures. Then we're going to look at the low-carb diet and how it helps alleviate inherited forms of disease. We're also going to look at how the CDC scientists expose agencies' corruption. That's a special report from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I filmed yesterday in California for my new film, and it was almost galvanizing, riveting. I mean, spot-on discussions that this scientist, who will remain nameless at this point, was revealing about how we're being defrauded in the area of science about our health. Well, I'm going to go into that with Robert F. Kennedy's report as well. From our environmental segment today, we're going to look at the growing tornado impact that scientists just can't figure out. And this is from Climate News. What it means is that we're having more tornadoes in places we've never had them before, but they're getting worse where we have had them, bigger, much bigger. In fact, they recorded one tornado that was over a mile wide. Wow. Then, when the permamelt frost that has been there for thousands, tens of thousands of years, when it melts, what happens to all that stored carbon? We'll have a report from Stacy Morano of the environmental group telling us, should we be that concerned now? Yes, we should. And also in the airport, because frequently I'll fly out right after my show, film, and fly right back late that night. I meet people in airports all the time. They see me on a lot of PBS stations. And one man came over yesterday and he said, I saw you on PBS. I said, oh, thank you. He said, but I got a question. I really don't believe that we're that close to having some major problems with the environment. Given, yeah, there's been some excessive rain and some problems here and there, but you're making it sound on television like there's a bad, you know, scenario coming. I said, there is. He said, well, I just don't see the evidence. I said, have you looked? I've studied over 6,000 scientific reports, and it shows it. The fact that the mainstream media is not covering it in an honest way doesn't mean it's not happening. He said, well, you know, if you have something that can summarize all this, I have a documentary. In fact, I'm just completing it in the next week. So today, Alan, the attorney, for your benefit, I'm going to let you hear from, in my opinion, the most honest and insightful environmentalist on the planet, Professor Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Environmental Studies, University of Arizona. Guy does not have a filter at all when it comes to the truth. Whatever it is, like Paul Beckwith, they'll tell you. Now, a lot of other people will tell you something, but then pull it back by degrees of acceptance. If the truth would shock you, you won't get the full truth. They'll just give you the truth. So today, Guy McPherson will take on the newsroom. Perhaps Mr. Sorkin could appreciate that what he did in a television program, Guy McPherson analyzes and shows the truth is understated by television. You'll see what I'm talking about when you hear this wonderful 8-minute segment. And then we have a lot of people listening from Canada. We have a lot, if you saw our statistics. So for all of our friends in Canada, you thought you were getting a good progressive, a good liberal, when you got Trudeau. You didn't. You got a male version of Hillary Clinton. welcome to the reality. So what we're going to do is we're going to keep real close tabs on everything he does, because there's nothing that he has done thus far that shows a single progressive or common sense or virtuous choice when it comes to the Canada, its animals, its people, and its environment. So we're going to have on someone who is a real Liberal member of Parliament in Canada, and he takes on Trudeau and Kinder Morgan about the company can now expropriate land with no license to do so, and no one is saying anything about it. You should wake up, pay attention to what's going on in North Dakota, because it's about to happen to you. And who do you guess in all of Congress got it right? Now they got it right about the Middle East, our meddling, our regime change with Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. You'd never guess who now has come around and said, yep, we got it wrong. It was a better place with Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi. Not that they were nice people. They weren't. But boy, this guy is right. So you see, we have a lot of things to do. Oh, and also my guest in the second part of our program is Sean Stone. And we're going to talk about understanding the American country of war and strategic goals. Sean co-hosts a new program called Watching the Hawks on Russian TV, and he is the son of Academy Award-winning director Oliver Stone. Now, I just happened to have heard this morning on Guns and Butter, a very good program with Bonnie Faulkner. She produces it. She allows some Pacifica stations to air it. Thank goodness there are those who actually create great programs outside and generously allow them for free to air it. And I was listening this morning when she interviewed a person who is a real expert on this whole topic, and I'm sure is in the film. I have not had a chance to see the film, but after I heard the interview, I decided, let's do this. So we're going to do this today. So we're going to talk about a history of war, history of intervention, and that'll be my guest. So let's begin. The first time I was told that aluminum was a bad thing in the environment, even though it's one of the most common minerals on the planet, was when there was a study came out back in the early 1970s showing that aluminum in underarm or deodorants could get into the body and disrupt the hormone system. Then the whole idea of having aluminum in those little dishes that you put into a microwave, and they, when it heated up, the aluminum leached out into the food. But all the while, the federal government was saying not to worry, very little leaches out, and nothing to do anyone any harm. But then the studies continued to accumulate. In fact, in the toxicological data, which we were discussing yesterday with one of the three people I filmed, he is a toxicologist, and he specializes in aluminum in the body. And he says there is no safe level, none, not even parts per billion. You don't want aluminum in the bottle. And then explain why, how it disrupts your neurons in your brain, how it disrupts the oxygenation of the tissue, how it creates oxidative stress, how it causes dysfunction in your central nervous system and digestion, and destroys mitochondria in your gut. All bad. This is the latest. This is from Professor Chris Exley, who is a professor of bioorganic chemistry at Keele University, which is in Great Britain. Quote, aluminum does cause Alzheimer's. This is according to new study findings, confirmed the metal plays a role in the devastating brain disease. Quote, a link between aluminum and Alzheimer's disease has long existed, but many scientists say there is not enough evidence to blame the metal used by thousands in every city, every day. However, Professor Chris Exley from Keele University says his latest research confirms it does indeed play a role in cognitive decline. By the way, cognitive decline is where your cognition begins to diminish. Good example. Hey, Gary, real true story. Do you want to have dinner tonight? We haven't had dinner in a long time, but, you know, you got time? Around 7, 8 o'clock? Sure. Okay. Come dinner time, he'd forgotten. But I had had dinner 5 times in the previous 5 days with my friend. That's cognitive decline the next day. Hey, Gary, you want to have dinner? Every day at 10 o'clock, drops by the office. Sure. Completely unaware of the previous conversations, within a 5-minute conversation, repeating the same sentence 5 to 10 times, unaware of it. That's cognitive decline. Forgetting people's names, forgetting the titles of movies, forgetting what you just read in a newspaper or book, cognitive decline. This is why you can't wait till a classically defined and diagnosed illness. Look at the symptoms leading up to it. So, aluminum precipitates that. And this was published in a medical site called Hippocratic Post. And he says there is a strong link, quote, between human exposure to aluminum and the incidence of Alzheimer's disease for more than the last 50 years, this evidence has been present. So we took a look back at the scientific literature, and sure enough, it's been there all along. This is just the latest in that. So that's the bad news. Now imagine that almost 70% of all vaccines have high amounts of aluminum as an adjuvant, which means it's there to make the other ingredients even more potent. Now, what do you do about it? You got a body that's filled with aluminum, and it will not break down. It will not leave the body of its own accord. You have to chelate it out. This is where what the naturalists, the hygienists, have been doing for a long time proved to be accurate. You start taking in vitamin C orally, buffered, ideally in a protein shake. You make that protein shake in the morning and put like 10,000 to 15,000 milligrams of vitamin C in it. And then throughout the day, you take a drink or two. Not a lot, 1 or 2 ounces at a time. It's getting about 1,000 milligrams an hour or so into your body. If you get too much, your body will give you a little loose stools. But if you're doing it right, it's going in there and trapping the heavy metals, not just aluminum, but lead, cadmium, nickel, and mercury as well, and then taking it out of the body. If, however, a mineral analysis comes back showing you've got a lot of heavy metals, not just aluminum, then you'll have to go to EDTA, ethylene, diamine, tetracyclic acid, or one of the other chelating agents. And by the way, intravenous vitamin A and vitamin C are extremely powerful. Aqueous vitamin A, water-soluble. At 50 to 75,000 milligrams, you're taking a lot of heavy metals out of your body. And that's why, after about 3 to 6 months of chelation therapy or intravenous vitamin C therapy together, people's readings went back to normal. Their energy increased. Enzymes activity picked up in the body. So get the heavy metals out of your body. And then lastly, drinking green juices. Chlorophyll is a natural chelator. It also helps detoxify. It also helps thin the blood, preventing strokes. It energizes and oxygenated red blood cells. So you have more energy in the mitochondria. You simply feel better. So those are the different ways we can get that mercury out of our body, but it's in there and it's not doing us any good. A separate piece that I thought was interesting is from Paul Fassa from Health Impact News. And he says that the federal government works with pharmaceutical companies to prevent natural cures. And I read the article, and right now the government is attacking homeopathy. And so beginning about a month ago, and going probably for the next year, you will see mainstream media in all of its different forms talking about how homeopathy is a fraud, it doesn't work, it's just expensive water. They're wrong. We have done an exhaustive research on homeopathy. There are dozens of quality studies showing that homeopathy works, including double-blind placebo-controlled studies. But there's no real strong advocates in the media. and only a tiny percentage of even holistic doctors know how to use it. In all of New York City, I only knew two doctors who were really classically trained homeopaths. One was Marty Feldman. He's gone. So what a person doesn't understand, hasn't used, they're less likely to know anything about or even do research. So what I'll do is this. I will post all of the peer-reviewed scientific independent studies showing homeopathy works, why it works, how it works, and I will post that on my site. So therefore, if you come across, and you will, the attacks, and they are starting, and the so-called health experts who have no background in health. In fact, when I went to debate one of these on national television, I'm going to find that tape. It was on the David Susskind show, and it's nationally televised, where a so-called quackbuster came on, and they confused my soft voice and pleasant personality with challenging the truth. That was a big mistake on his part. You have to watch to understand the importance of the context of what I just said. And by the end of it, anyone watching would have been absolutely confirmed that there's enormous bias, ignorance. Ask a question. What degrees in nutrition do you have? Credited degrees. None? Oh, okay. You give dietary advice. Are you a registered dietitian? You're not? Oh. Are you a scientist? Have you done original peer-reviewed literature, published work, and presented before a group of your peers on original research on nutrition? You haven't? And so exactly what gives you the expertise to say that everyone else in the field who does have these credentials is wrong? Oh, your opinion. I see. Your opinion doesn't account for anything. You say something doesn't work? Here are 35,000 studies. I actually took 35,000 studies on vitamin C alone, just that. Didn't know those existed? You thought it just created expensive urine? Well, there's 35,000 different scientific institutions and scientists and physicians and the journals who beg to disagree with you. There's the biochemistry, safety, efficacy, and potency studies. So on the one hand, we have your opinion, light as a feather, or more likely, a piece of fetid dirt in one hand, and we have 35,000 studies on one topic that you say there's no science to justify. On the other hand, you don't have to have a background in science to realize that virtually all the people out there talking about health and environmental issues have no qualifications, no background, and they are all attached to or affiliated with the industries, the pharmaceutical industry, whatever industry they're coming on to tell you why what you've heard is not true. So we've known for a long time that the FDA is biased. We know that its panels are stacked with so-called experts who come from the very industries that we should be concerned about and extremely diligent. So just don't believe anything that you hear from anyone who's attacking homeopathy till you've first done your homework. And also, they're also leading the attack, the FDA, against the legalization of cannabis. Ironic, because if you Google PubMed, you'll find over 15,000 articles on medicine and cannabis. It cures so many different conditions, improves so many different conditions, and it's in their own literature. And it's in the Library of Medicine. One of those ironies and contradictions. Talk about ironies and contradictions. Yesterday I filmed a lawyer who also happens to be a scientist whose own son developed autism. And everywhere he went to try to find out what was going on, he could not get help. All he got was denials. So finally he began to look into this in depth. And what he found was that there are over 80 cases where the actual fund that is set aside, where you can go into a vaccine court and argue your case and present your science, and it's very difficult to get them to accept a case, let alone to adjudicate in behalf of the plaintiff. But it actually shows in their actual final rulings that the vaccines, including the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella are associated with autism spectrum disorder conditions. So here on the one hand, you have an official agency of the U.S. government with the strictest standards for scientific evidence to present. And on the other hand, you have three other governmental agencies, the FDA, the CDC, and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, all saying there's never been a study proving a connection between vaccines and autism, except it's another agency of government that shows they're wrong. Oh, and these others have been found in gross conflict of interest and fraud and tampering with evidence and obfuscation constantly. So we got that on the record with people's names. And then I said, have you ever known any of the people from the CDC to go on congressional testimony floor under oath and lie? He said, yes. So he named the people. So we found the clips. There they are, lying. And then we show the truth, that at the time they were, before they're saying things about vaccines being safe, they had evidence that they were trying to hide, alter, which is a federal crime, showing that this was not true. Now we're going to start a whole campaign to ask for a special prosecutor and ask members of Congress, bring these people back and let them recant their testimony, apologize, and then tell the truth, or prosecute them. So, a lot's being done. That was just yesterday. And finally, a low-carb diet alleviates inherited forms of disabilities. This is Johns Hopkins University. If you're on a high-quality plant-based diet, so you're getting your protein, your minerals, your vitamins, fibers, essential fatty acids from walnuts and almonds and avocados and beans and legumes, you're getting all the nutrition your body needs, but not a surplus of what you don't need. Yesterday I was mentioning that we have a fetish about protein. We think we're not getting enough protein because we've been propagandized, especially those of us who are athletes. And so you'll all of the time see athletes taking way too much protein. Big problem with that, A, your body can't store it. So as I mentioned, what it can't store, it has to break down, what's called deaminization. And that creates two byproducts, ammonium, which is very, very bad for you, and also excess nitrogen in the body. And that taxes the kidneys and urea. So that's where you end up with brain fog and fatigue and achy muscles. So then the question is, if you were to walk into a restaurant based upon a normal serving of meat, how much meat, if you were accepting, I'm only going to get my protein from meat, how much meat should you be served so the body was not needing to break excess down? One forkful. Or what would fit in a spoon? One single piece on a plate is all your body requires. So what would happen if you had a menu that says we're feeding you what your body needs, not what your temperament wants? We could cut obesity, heart disease, cancers, pain by probably 70%. But people want what they don't need and frequently get what harms them. So the more meat you eat, the more animal proteins you consume, the quicker you're going to die. It's that simple. And all the science proves that. We have probably the largest collection of peer-reviewed scientific literature in the world on these topics. In fact, when I was asked would I go to Europe and testify on behalf of the American consumer and healthcare practitioner about the Codex Alimentarius, I submitted 550,000 scientific abstracts. We sent them that I had my collection showing that the information they were presented with was wrong, biased, and we should not be harmonizing our nutrients because they had not looked at the actual scientific literature. They had accepted the word of experts, all affiliated with special pharmaceutical companies that don't want you taking vitamins. They don't want you eating a vegetarian diet. They don't want you. Remember, there's an enormous amount of money at risk, probably close to about a minimum of $500 billion a year between the drugs you take. You wouldn't have to if you were healthy. The food you eat, meat, dairy, eggs, pork, those are big industries. Soft drinks, big industry. Now, if you If you say, are any of those products that we're consuming every day good for us? Show me the science. You can't. It doesn't exist. You have tried and you've been exposed by fraudulent science because there are people like myself and others who are scientists. We will read the literature, we'll show where you're wrong, and we'll write and rebut. The trouble is we don't have the same forms you have. But that doesn't mean that we don't have the truth. Now, how many articles exist showing you that when you eat meat, the way we eat it, and sugar, you're shortening your lifespan by up to about 9 years? Well, we have a lot of studies from peer-reviewed literature. Then why aren't we having health reporters, that's an oxymoron, at any station doing independent work? Well, that's not possible. You have these dancing little freakish clowns, you know, these mad clowns, and they put a disguise on. They're a health reporter. No, you're not. You're a pimp, and you should wear an appropriate pimp outfit. And we expect you to walk out there with an attitude, dress like a pimp with some pimp music in the background, and let us know, even get out of your pimp mobile and say, I'm here to represent Big Pharma. I want you to take this product because you've got bad digestion. Now, don't change what you're eating. Don't change wrong food combining. Don't change gluttony. Don't change stupidity. Just take this antacid. Of course, you won't digest anything, but you won't be having the pizza slapping you in the face or that salami and bologna slapping you either. And you think, wow, if I see it like that, it gives me a different perception that almost all the commercials are wrong. Oh, and get a really attractive woman who comes right up close to the camera very suggestively and says, make sure that your man has this Viagra when they go someplace, because we don't want him not being able to get an erection at the right time when you're both in bathtub somewhere overlooking an ocean. And I'm thinking, how do they get the water in the bathtub? I'm sure you've seen these stupid ads. Oh, and when the right moment comes and they're in the middle of a dance and you want to make sure that, you know, he's got at least 4 hours in erection. Okay, so does that mean that you're going to put 4 hours worth of Barry White music on so we can watch you having sex in the dance floor and no one else is going to notice? You're the senior singer, so they won't notice. Just give them some more canned beans. Good. I just sit there and make fun of the commercials because they're all so stupid. All of them. But behind it all is disease and death. Look behind what it is that they're trying to tell you. Look who benefits from it. Disinformation, misinformation, they win. Doing your homework, you win. The prize, death. The prize, vital life. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting in our studios in New York. And by the way, we want to let people know that if for any reason, Monday to Friday, noon to 1 o'clock, if you're not near an internet source or you're not near, one of the land-based stations, you can always go to the telephone and call a number and listen to the program. To listen live Monday to Friday, noon to 1, call 701-801-3662, 701-801-3662. Or if you miss a show and have to listen late at night, fine. There's an archival phone number or any portable listening device off your computer as well, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. Now, let's give you a reality check on the environment.
Yeah. video clip that appeared on an HBO program called The Newsroom, written by Aaron Sorkin.
And joining us now in studio is Richard Westbrook, Deputy Assistant Administrator of the EPA. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Westbrook, you've spent most of your professional career as a climate scientist in the public sector.
Yes, 10 years as a supervisory management analyst in the Office of Environmental Information. And before that, I was a program specialist in the EPA's Resource Management Division.
And you have a PhD in climate science from Stanford.
Yes, and another in chemistry with a master's in biology.
Okay. Tell us about the findings in the report that was just released.
The latest measurements taken at Mauna Loa in Hawaii indicate a CO2 level of 400 parts per million.
Just so we know what we're talking about, if you were a doctor and we were the patient, what's your prognosis? 1,000 years? 2,000 years?
A person has already been born who will die due to catastrophic failure of the planet.
What did he just say?
Okay, can you expand on that?
Sure. The last time there was this much CO2 in the air, the oceans were 80 feet higher than they are now. Two things you should know. Half the world's population lives within 120 miles of an ocean.
And the other?
Humans can't breathe underwater.
You're saying the situation's dire.
Not exactly. Your house is burning to the ground. The situation's dire. Your house has already burned to the ground. Situation's over.
So what can we do to reverse this?
Well, there's a lot we could do.
Good.
If it were 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, but now, no.
Can you make an analogy that might help us understand?
Sure. It's as if you're sitting in your car, in your garage, with the engine running and the door closed, and you've slipped into unconsciousness, and that's it.
What if someone comes and opens the door?
You're already dead.
What if the person got there in time?
You'd be saved.
Okay.
So now what's the CO2 equivalent of the getting there on time?
Shutting off the car 20 years ago.
You sound like you're saying it's hopeless.
Yeah.
Is that the administration's position or yours?
There isn't a position on this any more than there's a position on the temperature at which water boils.
The administration, let me try to... Your administration.
And don't forget, I need you to stretch 40.
It supports wind and solar, clean coal, nuclear power, raising fuel economy standards, and building a more efficient electrical grid.
Yes.
And?
That would have been great.
Let's see if we can't find a better spin. People are starting their weekends. The report says we can release 565 more gigatons of CO2 without the effects being calamitous.
It says we can only release 565 gigatons.
So what if we only release 564?
Well, then we would have a reasonable shot at some form of dystopian post-apocalyptic life. But the carbon dioxide in the oil that we've already leased is 2,795 gigatons. So
what would all this look like?
Well, mass migrations, food and water shortages,
spread of deadly disease, endless wildfires.
Way too many to keep under control. Storms that have the power to level cities, blacken out the sky, and create permanent darkness.
Are you going to get in trouble for saying this publicly?
Who cares?
Mr. Westbrook,
we want to inform people, but we don't want to alarm them. Can you give us a reason to be optimistic?
Well, that's the thing, Will. Americans are optimistic by nature. And if we face this problem head on, if we listen to our best scientists and act decisively, and passionately, I still don't see any way we can survive.
Okay. Richard Westbrook,
Deputy Assistant Administrator of the EPA. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Newsnight. We'll be back right after this.
I want to walk through some of the things the character said. He mentioned 80-foot sea level rise, which is 20-meter sea level rise, as being already locked in. But he failed to mention that at actually 385 parts per million, he was pointing out we were at 400, we're now at 409 parts per million. At 385 parts per million, there's 23-meter sea level rise locked in, and also a 6C global average temperature rise locked in. The heating associated with carbon dioxide currently in the atmosphere will persist for at least 1,000 years, according to a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, February 2012. We've known this for a long time. The official also talked about mass migrations. What he meant was a refugee crisis. Migration, as any biologist knows, is a two-way street. We have migratory birds. That means they move south in the winter and move north in the summer. They migrate. They're not refugees. What we're seeing right now is a refugee crisis, the likes of which the world has never seen. Why are people leaving the Middle East and Northern Africa? Why are people leaving Pacific Island states? Because there's no habitat for humans there anymore. It's simple when you view it from a biological perspective. It's absolutely simple. Climate exodus is expected, really expected, in the Middle East and Northern Africa. I was in Europe about a year ago on a speaking tour, and everywhere I went in Western Europe, people were complaining, Donald Trump style, about the Middle Easterners and Northern Africans fleeing into their countries. And they wanted to keep them out. It's underway. The mainstream media is catching on, finally, this week. And last week, when U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell said, we will have climate refugees. Well, of course she said that, because we already do. And finally, the government is admitting as much, just like the mainstream media is admitting as much, that these things are already underway. The character talked about food and water shortages. Again, they're underway. Syria, people are not leaving Syria because they're looking for a vacation. People are leaving Syria because the food they've relied upon for thousands of years of human society in Syria is gone. And it ain't coming back. Water shortages, we're running out of water. And the world's powers, whoever that is, I thought it was us, but maybe that's just me, are very worried, and with good reason. The spread of deadly disease has been underway for a while with things like Lyme and malaria and dengue and now Zika. And finally, it might actually make people notice in the United States because we have the first American that dies of complications due to Zika. Oh, none of that mattered when it was brown people. Now did it. But now it's Americans who are actually dying from the spread of deadly diseases as a result of climate change. I was teaching this very topic in my classes 15, 20 years ago as something that would be on the way. The mainstream media is still telling you that it's on the way. It's not on the way. It's here.
Again. Well, we want to thank Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson, and he is. I filmed him. We just have him in the brand new film that I'm doing on the world that we live in. He's brutally honest, and there are not any positive solutions for some of the tipping points. If you live near the water and the Larsen C ice shelf breaks, which we believe it will within the next 24 months, and they said the Larsen B shelf, which is much, much smaller, would not break for 100 to 200 years. It broke 9 days after their official announcements. This is huge compared to that. It is 70 miles long, 3/4 mile deep, and 300 yards wide, one piece of ice. That in itself, when that breaks, and it will, overnight, and it'll happen overnight, it'll calve overnight. That's putting all that fresh water into the ocean. In the southern hemisphere, you're going to see as much in some places as 11 feet of additional water. You'll also see, for every foot of water that rises in the ocean, you could lose 100 feet inland. Plus, when that water does come in at night, it's going to go into and then go down into the subsoil, into aquifers, and pollute those aquifers. And if you don't have a desalinization process, which 99% of the country doesn't, you're not going to be able to drink your water. And when we talk about living in denial, just this week, Corpus Christi, Texas, nobody can drink their water. There is a pollutant, a spill, into their aquifer. Aquifers cannot be cleaned up. The whole idea of the answer to pollution is dilution doesn't work with aquifers. You have a contained prehistoric body of water. You put something in it that's polluting, it's going to pollute the whole thing. And so now they're in long lines in Corpus Christi, one of the most popular destinations in Texas. There's already 1,223 separate towns representing 6.2 million people in Texas who are water insecure at this moment. We have 20 states that will not get out of this drought. Some states have virtually no water of their own, no aquifers. Nevada is one. Other states you never thought of being in drought, but are New York State. Upper New York State, Montgomery County, Columbia County, a lot of the counties are in severe drought. That means fire. that means you're going to have a big problem with agriculture. And look at all the other mess. 36,000 fires, 12,400 unique and extreme weather events in the last 12 months just in the United States. And exactly when did the president or his cabinet come forward or the media and say, here's the truth about our state of the environment. Here's what we must start to do now. It hasn't happened and it won't. Remember, even the Paris Accords, those are voluntary. And that what we need to do, we're not going to. So is it going to be bad? You bet it's going to be bad. Will most people be impacted? 90% of all Americans over the next 5 years will be severely impacted. Will we have food riots? For the first time, we will in the United States. 22 countries experienced food riots in the last 12 months. And if Germany is now having problems with its immigrants, and you only had about 4 million immigrants out of 7 million make it that far, what are you going to do with 200 million African food-impoverished people who are having to immigrate, not because of politics or civil war, but because of severe drought, severe weather, and no crops to eat? So that's why we deal with these issues. Let's go over now and say hello to my guest who is standing by in Southern California, Sean Stone. I gave you his bio earlier in the day. And also he is the director of a new program, new programs on Russian TV, co-hosts Watching the Hawks. And he also has a new film out that we're going to talk about. Nice to have you with us today, Sean.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sean, I only recently had a chance to learn about your documentary, so I have not yet watched it. But I did hear William Ingdahl this morning on Bonnie Faulkner's show discuss, you know, some of the background and circumstances we're faced with. Now, specifically, the city of Detroit is featured in your program, from what I understand, and been to Detroit many, many times, and seeing how part of it is booming and the other part is in decay, and the emphasis is upon what is booming, not on what is decaying, then it shows me that if we can allow a once prosperous city to collapse, then what does that portend as a national model for manufacturing or better standard of living or more democratic process in helping those other than the private capitalist interest? And Detroit at one time had the highest standard of living in America. Today, yeah, it's a basket case. So take us on that journey, please.
Well, yeah. In fact, of course, the documentary is designed to actually get us into thinking about how to take charge and find solutions for the problems that we face involving the things you've just discussed as well, the issues of climate change, but also we look, for example, particularly at going beyond the petrodollar economy into things like more local economy with wind and solar, but then also the future of fission and fusion energy. We talk about desalination processes, irrigation, many things that are very, very problem-solving oriented. So the idea is to look back into the past first to recognize that we were, at one point, I believe, more science and technology-driven by an industrial blue-collar base in our country, especially coming out of World War II, out of the Great Depression and the New Deal policies, right, to raise the standard of living across the board. And so that's where you get Detroit, was an outgrowth of those manufacturing abilities and, you know, personnel, right? So in the course of the boom of the war era, all the way through the 50s and 60s, Detroit became, as you said, had the highest standard of living for people. And yes, there were some, you know, racial issues and occasional divides and racism. But at the end of the day, the blue-collar worker was well-paid, was able to afford an average, you know, a man could afford a family of four people to take care of. You know, you'd be able to afford your house and on a mortgage, and ultimately, you know, you'd have cars, things like this. And now what happened in the course, I would say, of the post-60s era from the 70s forward with this policies across the board of not only deindustrialization, but overall lack of interest in our infrastructure, investing in infrastructure, a financialization of the economy, basically letting Wall Street financial policies dictate our investments, have basically taking us away from long-term foresight when it comes to, like we talked about the New Deal policies, right? There was a government initiative to invest in things for the future benefit of the country. That was basically stripped away with the desire for, I think, for more profit-seeking in the short term, and stripping that, you know, stripping of companies, especially in the 80s, we saw that, right? The Gordon Gekko type of thing. And so over the course of that 40-year time period, you can see very clearly people like Elizabeth Warren came on the scene talking about this. There was a decline in the middle class. This notion of real wages was starkly decreased. From 1970 until now, the real wage has gone down. The real minimum wage has gone down, what you can actually buy with it, purchase with it. And so it's basically put everyone into a system of debt. And some have been able to prosper and, you know, basically find ways of being entrepreneurial and, you know, maybe making the right investments, because Wall Street has been booming over that 40-year time period. But the actual real economy, the physical economy, has declined in this country.
Why are we now investing only in that which has power, and virtually minimal to no investment in our poorest neighborhoods and cities, such as Baltimore and Oakland? And the wealth is certainly there if the motivation to do what is correct is there. Or is there a larger purpose for expanding poverty? I just say that as a question, as a hypothesis. How does the private bank and corporate interest from keeping poverty around amongst us, do they have a motive for this? Or is it more insidious? For example, reducing the lifespan of the poor intentionally and keeping social services privatized means that some people and industries can benefit off the misery of others. Or do you see that as just being cynical?
No, I see, you know, again, the documentary gets into this notion of the scarcity of resources, right? We are taught in economics, basic economics, is that that which is scarce has more value, right? And so if you take that to the notion of money, for example, of control of actual assets and wealth, you know, obviously the more scarce it is, the more power you can have if you could control it. The same with issuing, you know, how do you say this? The same with controlling the currency, right? The Federal Reserve, the private bank issues the currency for our country, loans it into circulation. So already they can create the scarcity through their own fictitious supply and demand, but essentially they're issuing it. They can also curtail it. So they're controlling scarcity in a sense. That's the kind of that pertains, I would say, to all aspects of our globalized economy, where you have a concentration of wealth into these massive corporations. And we've seen it from some of these studies. I think there was one done by the Swedes in 2013 where they looked at the major asset holders across the globe. And it was basically 1,000 corporations that had about half of the planet's assets in terms of, like, controlling stake in about half of the planet's global economy. And of those 1,000 corporations, it was essentially only 50 interlocking almost like, how you say, corporate sort of companies, you know, behind it, management companies. There were a few banks and massive major corporations that were at the center. Only 50 that were at the center of most of those 1,000 corporations that had half of the world's wealth in their asset management. So you think about that, how small the accumulation has become globally, right, because of this process of globalization. And you realize this is why the investments are not happening into the poor communities. In the documentary, we talked to people like Catherine Austin Fitz, the former secretary of HUD, and she talks about how when she's tried to basically get investments into poor communities, of course, the big global franchises, the Walmarts, the Subways, the McDonald's, come in and buy up those small mom-and-pop type of stores as soon as they start to boom, right? And that's what we've seen, I think, across the board, is that the poverty has become endemic because the mid-size businesses have ultimately been bought up by the conglomerations. And the conglomerates have become so big and powerful because they've become transnational and, you know, basically globalized. Mm-hmm. And so that is part of what I would call the New World Order system, which is ultimately transferring power from the nation state to the globalized corporations. And then because of that power and wealth they've accumulated, they had much easier for them to buy off politicians, you see, in those circumstances.
Just I'll follow up with a conclusion on that. You just mentioned the New World Order. That term carries a lot of baggage. On the one hand, it evokes a lot of conspiracy theories, some that are well-founded in history and others that are clearly off the mark. And nevertheless, that term first came into the public notice with George Bush Sr.
Yeah.
after the collapse of the Soviet Union in a public speech. And Bill Clinton has used it. Henry Kissinger. These are all the stalwarts of the establishment, the corporatocracy. And there can be little doubt that factions during the course of U.S. history have viewed America's hegemonic role as the preeminent nation that would bring order across the globe. And order is what they crave so they can control everything. They control commerce. They control the laws. They control all trade. And mm-hmm. very few people will have ever heard of William Yandel Elliott, a Harvard professor and historian, who developed a strategy that would create a monolithic national security state that would be incorporated into the British Empire, which was the mm-hmm. vision of the British Roundtable movement. So that was a reality, and that was a vision of what was to come with this New World Order. So we're right now with the people who believe in creating a New World Order, like Carter's former Secretary of State, Zbigniew Brzezinski, whose daughter's right. on Morning Joe, and he was an architect of this. Henry Kissinger was an architect of this, but they had a lot of other people who put it into place. And today, the bearers of this standard of allegiance would be the Council on Foreign Relations, the Business Roundtable. These are real people, real groups, and they have an enormous amount of power over policy, both domestic and foreign. Your final thoughts, please.
Absolutely. As you point out, it's a real concept in the book that I wrote, as you mentioned, based in my exploration of William Yandel Elliott and his intellectual history. I kept coming across this term, New World Order, going back to the British imperial documents when they were having Commonwealth meetings in the 20s and 30s. People like H.G. Wells were writing books called New World Order. Elliott and others were writing that concept in the 50s, New World Order, because it is a real concept of how they, you know, these intellectual elitists were trying to basically organize world power and to keep and consolidate their own movement to maintain the empire. And a lot of that empire had to do with, again, controlling resources and converting the colonies, because remember, we came from we were entering a post-colonial world, but the colonial world is about controlling resources, right? Access to the dark-skinned peoples of the world and their resources. So it was a question of how do we basically keep our access to those resources under the pretense of giving them freedom and equality, but really it's under our legal systems of international monetary control, international legal agreements, trade agreements, these type of things that basically would keep the access to the resources of, you know, most of the planet.
Well, I thank you, and hopefully people will watch you on Watching the Hawks. How can people get a copy of your documentary?
Mm-hmm. So my documentary is called Century of War. And Century of War is available online on RT.com or on YouTube. And the book New World Order is available on Amazon should be at any available good bookseller.
Well, good. All the best on both projects, Sean.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.